The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Yeah, I don't know. I suppose, yeah, they could be quite old, I suppose. Ralph Waldo Emerson attended in 1833, and he describes it in his journal. The famous Miserere was sung this afternoon in the Sistine Chapel. The saying at Rome is that it cannot be imitated, not only by any other choir, but by any other chapel in the world. The Emperor of Austria sent Mozart to Rome on purpose to have it sung at Vienna with like effect, but it failed. Surely it is sweet music and sound, more like the Aeolian harp than anything else. The lessons of pathos of the day relate the treachery of Judas and apply select passages from the prophets and psalms to the circumstances of Jesus. Then, whilst the choir chant the words, and then he gives the words, all the candles in the chapel are extinguished but one. During the repetition of the verse, the last candle is taken down and hidden under the altar. Then out of the silence and the darkness rises the most plaintive and melodious strain, the whole congregation kneeling, Miserere Mei Deus. The sight and sound are very touching. Everything is in good taste. The choir are concealed by the high fence which rises above their heads. We were in a Michelangelo chapel, which is full of the noblest scriptural forms and faces and so on. So these authors would come and visit and be deeply moved, or in the case of some, unimpressed. But they had to be there. They had to go. And it was the thing to do, and it gained in reputation. Goethe, as well, visited. And he was very, very touched. He makes interesting comments. I mean, there's nothing like music. I suppose only religion and politics have as many strong, opinionated people attached to them. But here's one entry in Goethe's journal. It struck me yesterday evening in St. Peter's when the choir was singing the Vesper hymn to organ accompaniment. What an odious instrument the organ is. It doesn't blend with the human voice and is so powerful. On the other hand, how charming the sounds in the Sistine Chapel where the voices are alone. And he talks about various pieces of Palestrina that he heard and of course, the Miserere. He doesn't like Catholicism much, but he does recognize the depth of tradition. Goethe says he admired everything. It must be said to their credit that they have made a thorough study of the Christian tradition. In the papal ceremonies, in the Sistine Chapel, everything that usually appears unpleasant in the Catholic divine service proceeds with great taste and perfect dignity. However, this can only happen in a place where for centuries all the arts have been at the church's disposal. So there's this increasing romanticism about the church. As you probably know, romanticism, as it grew up in Germany and in England and in France, was very often sympathetic to a kind of version of the Catholic Church, which picked and chose what they wanted and left what they didn't want. But the reason for the sudden new popularity of the Catholic Church was several-fold. One, of course, simply political. As you know, the French Revolution had challenged Catholic and Baroque authority, and in its place had put reason, and the goddess of reason replaced the authority of the Church, and they had masses in celebration of reason and This soon was not only very disappointing humanly, because it didn't do much for people, but it was terrible and violent. And as you know, the Reign of Terror was one of the most frightening episodes in European history. And then came the Restoration. In 1814 and 1815, Napoleon was defeated, Napoleon being the last representative of the revolutionary tradition. He was defeated. Europe was restored to its ancient contours. And in many cases, in many countries in Europe, kings were put back onto the throne, not always with the same authority and the same exclusive power as before the French Revolution. Most often it was a kind of parliamentary monarchy. Nevertheless, the mood was to come back to kingly authority, back to tradition, back to the higher things. And that was a natural for the comeback of Catholicism. Kings were crowned by the Pope's authority. Kings represented an authority which was shared in all of life. A sense of authority was very popular. Not only that, but besides the political mood, there was a kind of philosophical mood of conservatism and of seeking unity in a transcendental, otherworldly direction. Romantic longing was not what we think it is, which is just, well, nostalgia for the past, for better times. But romantic longing, or Sehnsucht, was this thirst for unity, this thirst for an all-embracing otherworldly reality which could transcend the petty squabbles and the petty fights of humanity. And the arts had a particular place in making this philosophy vivid. And of course, music more than any other of the arts, because it was ethereal, it was not concrete. It was an invisible art that touched the soul directly. And so you have all these reasons why so many people would flock to the Sistine Chapel to hear the papal choir sing the Miserere by Allegri, even though humanly and by dint of reason, you wouldn't have a lot of cause to appreciate, you know, an all-male choir and the hierarchy, or what Goethe calls the unpleasant side of Catholicism. So, you know, operas are written about religious themes, about the Catholic Church, or about some, you know, related religious thing. And this very much fit the times. French authors, as well as English, American, and German, visited the Sistine Chapel and were equally moved. Here is Chateaubriand, who is a fascinating author. He's the epitome of this mood. Chateaubriand wrote a couple of books called Atala and René, which were stories of American Indians. And it was kind of the noble savage. People going to America met these pure people who lived in nature, and they were closer to the spirit world and so on. And he was a Catholic Christian who wrote an apologetic book, and his argument is called The Argument from Beauty. You've heard of the cosmological proof and the ontological proof. This is the aesthetic proof. Chateaubriand was also the French ambassador to the Holy See, and he brings an interesting point of view to his to the all the writers we've seen so far. He writes in 1829 in Holy Week, April 15th. I've just left the Sistine Chapel where I attended Tenebrae and heard the Miserere sung. I remember that you had talked to me of this ceremony. He's writing to Madame Récamier. That's why there's the U here. which touched me 100 times as much because of that. Nice thing to say to someone. The daylight was failing. The shadows crept slowly across the frescoes of the chapel, and one distinguished but a few bold strokes of Michelangelo's brush. The candles extinguished one by one in turn, set forth from their stifled flames a slender white smoke, a very natural image of life, which Scripture compares to a little smoke. The cardinals were kneeling, the Pope prostrate before the same altar, where a few days before I had seen his predecessor, the admirable prayer of penance and mercy, which succeeded the lamentations of the prophets, and he rose at intervals in the silence of the night. One felt overwhelmed by the great mystery of a God dying, that the sins of mankind might be wiped out. The Catholic heiress was there on her seven hills, with all her memories. That's Rome. But instead of the powerful pontiffs, those cardinals who contended for precedence with monarchs, a poor old paralyzed pope, without family or support, princes of the church without splendor, announced the end of a power which had civilized the modern world. So he sees in this, I mean, we didn't go into this in historical detail, but the fact that the papacy was dwindling at this time. And the pope that he encountered was a feeble old man, and it seemed very poignant that he should be there, dying rather emaciated himself, and announcing the end of this power that had civilized the modern world. For Chateaubriand, the Catholic Church was Christendom, and that was the great error. Then he goes on, the masterpieces of the arts were disappearing with it, fading away on the walls and ceilings of the Vatican, that half-abandoned palace. Inquisitive strangers, separated from the unity of the church, assisted at the ceremony on their way and took the place of the community of the faithful. So we've got tourists now in the church. The heart was seized with a twofold sadness. Christian Rome, while commemorating the agony of Jesus Christ, seemed to be celebrating her own, to be repeating for the New Jerusalem the words which Jeremiah addressed to the old. And that's a very significant account, because unlike the more secular romantics, the Goethes and all, Chateaubriand was a believer, at least a Catholic believer, and so he saw this from the inside as the great a symbol of a great transition and a great loss. For him, it's all the more pathetic and all the more moving in that this era is over, this era of grandeur, and even the arts are failing. And it was typical of him and of a few other Catholics of that period to believe that, in fact, it was a time of decadence where the arts themselves would be failing. And so he brings an interesting dimension to it. In the middle of the century and towards the end of the 19th century, all kinds of figures came. Hans Christian Andersen came. The great story writers, the great folk lore collectors came. And in turn were moved. Many of them shared Chateaubriand's lamentations for a dying culture, although not necessarily because of religious reasons. Harriet Beecher Stowe, they all were there. Now, musicians went and have a particular technical appreciation for what is going on. And interestingly enough, many of the great musicians who went were sort of torn between the fact that the music wasn't technically very well performed or even very deep, some of it, and yet it still had this overwhelming effect. Mendelssohn is typical of this. He had a lot of complaints about the music he heard. The singers didn't have good enunciation. The words didn't come out clearly. The pitch was so uncertain, says Mendelssohn, that they could sink from E minor to almost B flat minor in the course of the Miserere. And that's a lot of, you know, some choirs worry about going down a half tone, you know. This is very flat. He says, you cannot conceive how tiresome and monotonous the effect is and how harshly and mechanically they chant through the Psalms. They sing with the accent of a number of men quarreling violently, and it sounds as if they were shouting the same thing furiously at each other, and so on. Nevertheless, Mendelssohn turns from this to words of great admiration. He believes that the musical moment was precious and parallel to very few. The ear finally becomes accustomed to the sound, he says, and the effect can be superb. He says if now and then very peculiar dissonances result, the effect in the music is not all bad. Let's just hope they will not do this with Johann Sebastian Bach, he writes. and his final judgment is very positive on this, again, because of the ambiance, because of the atmosphere and the feeling of it. What are we to conclude from this phenomenon? And it really is nothing short of a phenomenon. In the case of the Miserere in the Sistine Chapel. First of all, I think very obvious, but it's very important to say it, music is much more than the sum of its parts. This means that when people listen to music, they are listening to much more than the notes. And if it sounds obvious, and it is obvious, it's something that I think we Christians tend to forget when we're doing aesthetic studies or analysis. We easily fall into the traps of formalism and structuralism and all the different schools of today, which isolate the pure elements of pitch and dynamic and so forth without putting them into the larger cultural setting. And I've been pleading all along that music is a cultural response to God's revelation. And as cultural response, the notes, as it were, blend in and dovetail with social relations, tradition, various tastes that are found in groups, functions, you know, whether it's a wedding or a church service or entertainment or whatever it might be. And this element has to be understood if we're going to talk intelligently about music. Secondly, because music is cultural and because we live in a fallen world, there's a lot of room for misunderstandings of all kinds. The fact that people got so many of their impressions wrong, and the data was wrong in visiting the Sistine Chapel, is revealing in and of itself. People confused the papal choir with other choirs. They confused the Sistine Chapel with other churches. They confused the Miserere with the whole office of Tenebrae. Dickens, for example, writes of waiting in the galley for an hour or so while they were chanting the Miserere. Well, it's not possible. I played you about half of the piece there. It's not more than 10 minutes at the outside. They didn't know about the composers sometimes. They just thought it was a piece the choirs just sang. Added to which was all of this tremendous mystique based on Romanticism. And so I believe that while we must recognize music as a cultural phenomenon, we must be very careful to get the facts straight and to try and sort out the facts from the myth. And then third, as in the case of much music, the true significance of the music is often elsewhere than simply in the performance. And that's not a bad thing. You might think it's bad, and of course, ideally, you'd want the performance to be the source of much. But there is a place for the kinds of feelings and the kinds of memories and associations that music can provide simply because it is music. And this was exaggerated and mystified by the Romantics with the Miserere, but there's a valid element, I think, at the base of it. What else can I tell you? Well, let me just give some conclusions about music and language, and then why don't we open it up for discussion. 4 points here, just very briefly. First, the music-language gap can be bridged. But you've got to have a proper philosophical framework in which to do it. I think the Christian worldview is true enough and big enough to explain how music can be both very specific in its technical aspect and how you can be faithful to that in describing it, and much more cultural and associative and so on, so that music as metaphor can be deciphered at all kinds of different levels if we start with a Christian worldview, because the Christian worldview appreciates the fact that in the creation and in the arts, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Second, and in keeping with this, music must be understood in a cultural setting, or better, as a cultural creative response, if we're going to say what it means. In the case of the Miserere, you can't simply describe the notes. You've got to say it was in the Sistine Chapel. You've got to talk about Michelangelo. You've got to talk about the 3 centuries that led to this Romanticism in the 19th in order truly and fully to describe it. And this really runs counter to a lot of schools of interpretation today, which say that you shouldn't let historical development and authorial intention and so on interfere with what with your interpretation. I disagree. I think all of that is simply a part of the reality of the created world. Third, we can describe music accurately but not exhaustively. We may be able to describe music in words, but never reduce it to words. We might learn more and more by studying the context and the author's intention, the history, and so on. But we will never reduce music to words any more than we can reduce anything else to words or words to other things. As a matter of fact, you can't reduce poetry to narrative words. You can't reduce parables to propositions. You can describe what they do and their impact, and we must do that, but it won't be exhaustive. Finally, judgments of good and bad are necessary, but they can only be rendered effectively on condition that the nature of music is respected, the cultural property, and the fact that you can't reduce it. So judgment then can be made, and when you do make the judgment, it's got to go across the board from the technical parts of the music to the social organization, the context, and everything else. And you've got to decide between a Chateaubriand who regrets the end of an era and a Goethe who thinks, well, Catholicism's terrible, but here's some good salvageable music, or some English author who didn't like it at all. You've got to decide who's right and decide for yourself how to make such an evaluation. This does not mean you say yes or no. Doesn't mean you say good, bad, that the whole thing is good, the whole thing is bad. I think it's really, really unfair to judge a phenomenon as rich and complex as the Miserere, let alone the rest of music, by saying yes, good, or no, bad, can't have it, can't do it, Christians should stay away. That kind of Manichaean black and white approach simply ignores the riches of what we've said. So you've got to go much deeper. But I do think it can be done. And though I read some ridiculous examples to you at the beginning of how people have tried and failed to describe music, I have seen music well described. And there are critics who are very reliable and who do know how to put things into words and how to get the essence out and put it in a larger cultural setting. And I always appreciate them when they do that. Okay, I'm just going to stop there. That's all I have to say. Anybody want to? Not that I know of. Now, if you mean that the exclusive goal is to convince a secular person that this is the correct way to do things, I really don't know anything. If you mean that a work could, while being for us or the tribe, as well communicate to the outsiders, then I think I could probably think of some. I mean, my own little book that's way out of date now, Taking Note of Music, has been read quite a bit by non-Christians who will say they're challenged by it. You know, even, and a lot of them, like Goethe, will just dismiss all the religious stuff and say, but we really like what you're saying. My college roommate is not a Christian, but he's a close friend, and we met through music, and we've kept up ever since. He read it. He said he was amazed at how he agreed with many of my conclusions, but he could do without all the reasons. Go ahead. So I would say, you know, what about the reasons? Don't they have something to do with it? And push them along. There are books on particular areas of music which I think successfully convinced that this is the way to look at it. I'm very fond of Steve Turner's book about rock and roll, which is also dated. Called Hungry for Heaven. It's called. Yeah. He wrote a book on rock, yeah. Yeah. He's British. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a great poet. His book is very specialized. It's on rock and roll from about 1955 to about 1980. But he's interviewed a lot of the musicians involved personally. He writes for Rolling Stone and he works for BBC. And his particular grid is, I think, a very helpful one. He sees rock and roll as a secular attempt to find hope and meaning, and in the case of Christians, there's been a more or less successful marriage between the medium of rock and that search, but fulfilled in Christ. In the case of non-Christians, again, there's been a more or less authentic marriage of that search with rock and roll. So, I think a non-Christian could pick up that book and say, and be really challenged by it, even though it's not specially written for non-Christians. So they do, the books are, you know, dual-purpose books do exist, but it's rare. Well, there are many ways. I think one of the most effective is the old adult Sunday school, only because I've had some very good experiences doing that, and I know others have. If a church is struggling with issues of worship and music and so on, if you could tell them, give me 6 weeks to do a history of music with Christian interpretation, you can really open people's eyes. Another way to do it is getting on the worship team, if your church has one, and teaching the choir, teaching the orchestra certain things, you know, that musicians will appreciate, and they'll begin to see patterns, and they'll begin to wonder, why didn't I ever know about this stuff before? And, you know, so If you do it wrong, yeah, sure can. Yeah, it can be elitist or subversive. You'd have to, I think, carefully get the pastor and the elders to at least endorse it, if not to agree with it all. Because, you don't want to start a little revolution in your church by... Yes, that's right. You've got to teach. I think that's very important, and be patient with people. And also, be willing to work with the styles that people are at home with and see the good in those styles, even though they're not your own particular taste. I mean, I've always stressed missiological and relational dimensions in music. Missiological, because you're trying to reach people in a community, whether it's North Philadelphia or it's the suburbs or it's Chestnut Hill, who have a certain culture, or maybe a couple of cultures. And if you're imposing a foreign genre to them, which comes out of nowhere, you just won't be reaching them. Relational, because in the church you'll always find people who have very different tastes and preferences, and you've got to work out the music not by doing an end run around people that you'd rather not deal with, but by trying to convince them. Now, there's situations where you're never going to convince everyone. You're not going to convince so-and-so who just hates the guitar and refuses to listen to reason. But you can, I think, with some biblical principles, reach some. The strong and the weak brother of Romans 14 is, I think, a good lesson here. You know, you have people who can't listen to certain kinds of music because their conscience is tender, and you've got to help them along and say, well, no, you got it wrong. It's not idolatrous as such. Go ahead, try it out. So there are many, I think, relational dimensions to introducing music in the church. Having said that, that doesn't mean that you're kind of accommodating to whatever people want. You're leading them, nevertheless. And if you had some training and you know the issues, that leadership can be very effective. I think it's hard, but I think it can be done. Next week, as a matter of fact, we're going to discuss in the book next week. Somewhere I'm going to put in something about music and worship. Oh, yeah, there it is, April 27th. Music and the Regulative Principle. It's not just a narrow study of the Regulative Principle. It'll be about music and worship, and how to introduce certain principles into one's church. It's a good point. That's a very good point. Yeah. Yep. At La Brie, where I became a Christian, they had a very sophisticated view of music. They had Bach chorale books for all the congregation, you know. And they expected people to know these. And so the Breeites would come down off the mountain and back into America with their Bach chorale books, come to the average Baptist church and say, you guys are Philistines here, and listen to me. And it didn't go over, because it was done with snobbery rather than with compassion. Yes, I've listened to it over and over again. And that's a test, I think, of its effectiveness. And at least for me, it actually loses impact the more I hear it. Whereas when I listen to Palestrina, it gains an impact the more I hear it. And I think one of the reasons is that the kind of simplicity that is used is not an artistic simplicity. It's an emotional simplicity. It hits you with Gregorian chant, which reminds everybody of the church, you know, and then this very ethereal, pure sound with those very high notes and sopranos, and a few close chords that are tense and then they resolve. That just, unless it's within a larger structure which goes from A to Z or develops, ends up being kind of just empty emotionalism. So for me, it's actually not a great work of art, and that's partly why I chose it as an example, because it's just a phenomenon. And Mendelssohn and others recognized that. You know, they said, well, this, of course, he was talking more of performance, but they didn't, the piece itself wasn't just a great piece. Yeah, maybe theatrical or emotional, religious sentiment, you know, kind of nostalgic religious sentiment. Yeah, but see, in the case of the Miserere, it was used way beyond what its merit, I think, you know. People flocked from all over Europe and America to hear that piece, which was performed during 3 days in Holy Week, and that put the piece under pressure that it really can't stand. Now, if you did that with, you know, Beethoven's Missa Solemnis, well, that could probably take it, you know. Or, you know, the Mass in B minor or something like that. But, I agree that a piece like this used judiciously from time to time can be very effective. But, I mean, this went way beyond what the piece has in it. For all those reasons we mentioned, it was just, you know, this romanticism, Sistine Chapel, the Catholic Church, post-Napoleon, the pictures on the wall, the candles going out, the crowds, the mystique about you can't copy it, you know, and all that. All of that just was built to be this great big phenomenon. Sort of like Woodstock, you know. We look back and we're like, wow. It was interesting. But there were a lot of kids there, and there was some good music. But it wasn't this thing that people have made it into. You know, it gets bigger and bigger as you get farther away from it. Does that have a modem on it? My colleagues, I don't have one of those things, but my colleagues have ones which have modems, so they can do email from any hotel in the world. Yeah, are they? Yeah. And you then have to copy it onto your main computer if you want to save it, or just put it on disk. Uh-huh. Oh, you don't have one at all? Oh, boy. I don't know. Because I have... I don't know why we're talking about computers. But anyway. Okay, music. Yes. Dangerous. Oh, I couldn't resist.
See, my main issue is willingness to see a context other than your own.
That's extremely well put. It's very eloquent. I think that's exactly it. Yes. That's why I call it missiological and relational. I mean, those are fancy words, but unless you can sacrifice and look at the world from the other person's perspective, you'll be falsely under the illusion that you're a great musical connoisseur and they're not, and that's your problem. Your problem is, you know, you have a relational and missiological problem. Having said that, there are musical standards, and, you know, that can be brought in. But only when the missiological and relational are straight.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say not only.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's important stuff. I'm on this committee of the PCA on worship. And it's a big, big, big committee. There's 30 of us on it. And we divide up our labor so that we don't always meet in a plenary session. But it is amazing how confused the church is and how many different strong and differing opinions abound. And our task is very hard because we have to listen to these people. We have to come to a reasoned and biblical view. And it's hard because you're constantly playing off what you know to be good musically against what you believe is right relationally. And in the relational dimension, there's two problems. One is the strong and the weak brother, so that what Paul would say is that although the strong are right, the weak shouldn't be trampled on. But the second is legalism. Legalists are not weaker brothers. They are strong people who are wrong. And you've got to make a difference in your relationships between the weak brother who you know, loves Fanny Crosby or something and can't imagine singing Bach, you know, and helping that person along, a difference between them and the legalist who believes that only the 19th century sawdust trail music is Christian, and that's all you've got. You know, if you deviate from that, you are not a Christian. You're a suspect.
But they themselves are responding from a culture.
Yeah, that's what they don't realize. They've stopped the clock at their favorite place.
They're hermetically sealed and maybe they are looking out.
I know.